The season of light. Nice to close on that. So this brings us tonight to chapter 9 in the synthesis of yoga's first part, the Yoga of Divine Works, Equality and the Annihilation of Ego. When Sri Aurobindo wrote this chapter in the Arya, he titled it The Fullness of Renunciation. And it appeared on his birthday, August 15th, 1915. Of course, he rewrote it substantially in later years, either around 1932 or maybe in the early 1940s. As we go through it, we'll note many correspondences between what he's already written in his book, The Mother, and the basis for the Yoga of Works as we find it in the Bhagavad Gita. So, an entire self-consecration, a complete equality, an unsparing effacement of the ego, a transforming deliverance of the nature from its ignorant modes of action are the steps by which the surrender of all the being and nature to the divine will can be prepared and achieved, a self-giving, true, total, and without reserve. We could dance through the Gita and touch shloka after shloka, where he is citing those passages and pulling them into this elegant sentence. The complete equality, samatha, the effacement of the ego. Of course, in the Gita, the term ahankara is not used, so far as I'm aware. So the I-making sense of our natural selves, which is what in the Sankhya is the ego creator, is not used by the Gita, even though it refers to the Sankhya. But much is spoken about in the Gita about delivering the consciousness in freedom from subjection to the gunas and into the liberated state where one lives in the akshara purusha. He continues, the first necessity is an entire spirit of self-consecration in our works. It must become first the constant will, then the ingrained need in all the being, finally its automatic but living and conscious habit, the self-existent turn to do all action as a sacrifice to the Supreme and to the veiled power present in us and in all beings and in all the workings of the universe. This is the 12th chapter in the Gita, verses 13 to 14, and it's worth having a look at that. But again, chapters 2, 3, 4, 18 are some of the chapters in which these themes arise again and again. Because it is a life-affirming yoga that the Gita essentially espouses. But here, chapter 12, verses 13 and 14, he who has no egoism, no I-ness and my-ness, who has friendship and pity for all beings and hate for no living thing, who has a tranquil equality to pleasure and pain and is patient and forgiving, he who has a desireless content, the steadfast control of self, and the firm, unshakable will and resolution of the yogin, and a love and devotion which gives up the whole mind and reason to me, he is dear to me. So this is the entire being. The consciousness, the knower in us, the actor in us, the lover in us. All of it united in the absence of ego, in the self-giving constantly to the divine. By the way, I'm reading from a book that many of you will know from the late 30s, The Message of the Gita. This was compiled by Anil Baran Roy, one of Sri Aurobindo's disciples who was present in the early days of the ashram, who took passages from Sri Aurobindo's essays on the Gita and compiled them in this book. And Sri Aurobindo often rendered the Sanskrit into English. So Anil Baran did this work and in a sense wanted Sri Aurobindo to publish it as his translation. He said, no, it's not a translation, it's a rendering. And if you go through it, you can see that it is indeed a rendering, not a strict translation. Sri Aurobindo was an extraordinary translator when he wished to be, but here in his composition of the essays on the Gita, he was making a point. He was interpreting it largely and powerfully. And so I thought you'd like to see the book, and we're using this rendering as our translation. Full confession. So it goes on. Life is the altar of this sacrifice. Works are our offering. A transcendent and universal power and presence, as yet rather felt or glimpsed than known or seen by us, is the deity to whom they are offered. This sacrifice, this self-consecration, has two sides to it. There is the work itself, and there is the spirit in which it is done, the spirit of worship to the master of works in all that we see, think, and experience. Again, back to the Gita, the fourth chapter, the 24th verse. Brahmarpanam brahmahavi brahmagnau brahmanahutam brahmaivatena gantavyam brahmakarma samadina. The divine is the act of offering. The divine is the substance that is offered. The divine is the fire into which the offering is poured. The divine is the one who offers. The divine is the destination of one who works in communion with the divine. The work itself is at first determined by the best light we can command in our ignorance. It is that which we conceive as the thing that should be done, what we would call kartavyam karma. And whether it be shaped by our sense of duty, by our feeling for our fellow creatures, by our idea of what is for the good of others or the good of the world, or by the direction of one whom we accept as a human master, wiser than ourselves, and for us, the representative of that Lord of all works in whom we believe, but whom we do not yet know, the principle is the same. The essential of the sacrifice of works must be there, and the essential is the surrender of all desire for the fruit of our works, the renunciation of all attachment to the result for which yet we labor. And that, of course, is the second chapter, 47th shloka. Thou hast a right to action, but only to action, never to its fruits. Let not the fruits of thy works be thy motive, neither let there be in thee any attachment to inactivity. For so long as we work with attachment to the result, the sacrifice is offered not to the divine, but to our ego. We may think otherwise, but we are deceiving ourselves. We are making our idea of the divine, our sense of duty, our feeling for our fellow creatures, our idea of what is good for the world or others, even our obedience to the master a mask for our egoistic satisfactions and preferences, and a specious shield against the demand made on us to root all desire out of our nature. This is the Gita, Shloka 42 and 43, same chapter, second chapter. This flowery word, which they declare, who have not clear discernment, devoted to the creed of the Veda, whose creed is that there is nothing else. Souls of desire, seekers of paradise, it gives the fruits of the works of birth. It is multifarious with specialities of rites. It is directed to enjoyment and lordship as its goal. So the intelligence of those who are misled by that flowery word and cling to enjoyment and lordship is not established in the self with concentrated fixity. So we hide from ourselves our real motives. We impute upon our action the idea that we're doing this as noble self-offering, but the egoism in the work is secret to us, perhaps visible to our friends and family, but we think we're clear and free of it. Sri Aurobindo, of course, has a right to speak of this because he had, from the moment that he came back to India from England, worked progressively through the practice of yoga to achieve an inner equality and stability in his consciousness so that he was lifted out of the personal aspect of the action. And yet, even though he was living in a realization of Brahman, ego clung to him, as he noted in his Uttarpara speech, when the master of existence, if you will, whom he enjoyed calling Krishna, led him into a state of incarceration so that he could have a word with him. He led him into solitary confinement so that he could impart upon him a higher and greater revolution than simply the liberation of his country, which he said, "I will handle that, sir, but I have for you a different work. And since I couldn't get your attention because you felt you were so precious to it, that this was your service to the world, when indeed it is my work, I had to pull you out of it." Read that Uttarpara speech. It is very stirring. Sri Aurobindo was then led to a greater karma yoga than he had been practicing, and was able to efface within himself many elements of clinging ego which he had been unconscious about before. It is a practice that he took with him to Pondicherry when he went down there and established a cave of tapasya where he examined himself, the powers that flowed through him, and try to establish a clear transmission between that will through his being into the world and a complete offering of all that he met and experienced back to that. It's that shloka from the Gita that we just recited in Sanskrit, you know, this circularity. You give, it comes back. it goes again. Something greater comes back. And he was able, in this constant cycling of this energy, to bring into the compass of his physical experience the powers of divinity. They were actually meeting the material of his body, not simply his liberated psychological being, not simply his uplifted emotions and ennobled sense of what is there, the one who is in all beings, but this became increasingly a physical experience for him. So that this giving, this consecration, was possible because of this annihilation of ego in him. Ego is a fascinating occurrence. Can you call it an entity? At this stage of the yoga, and even throughout the yoga, this form of desire, this figure of the ego, is the enemy against whom we have to be always on our guard with an unsleeping vigilance. We need not be discouraged when we find him lurking within us and assuming all sorts of disguises, but we should be vigilant to detect him in all his masks and inexorable in expelling his influence. This was something Sri Aurobindo wrote about candidly with his disciples in his correspondence. He said, you have to be able to develop the power of giving yourself a straight look, of seeing what's there, not flinching. The illumining word of this movement is the decisive line of the Gita. To action thou hast a right, but never under any circumstances to its fruit. Again, that's 2:47. The fruit belongs solely to the Lord of all works. Our only business with it is to prepare success by a true and careful action and to offer it, if it comes, to the Divine Master. Afterwards, even as we have renounced attachment to the fruit, we must renounce attachment to the work also. At any moment, we must be prepared to change one work, one course, or one field of action for another, or abandon all works, if that is the clear command of the Master. Well, this is reminiscent of his book, The Mother. Remember, that was published in 1928, so a few years earlier than this, but Sri Aurobindo comes again and again back to this earlier book, which is, as I think M.P. Pundit described it, a magazine of spiritual power. So, chapter 5. If you want to be a true doer of divine works, your first aim must be to be totally free from all desire and self-regarding ego. All your life must be an offering and a sacrifice to the Supreme. Your only object in action shall be to serve, to receive, to fulfill, to become a manifesting instrument of the divine Shakti and her works. You must grow in the divine consciousness till there is no difference between your will and hers, no motive except her impulsion in you, no action that is not her conscious action in you and through you. Afterwards, even as we have renounced attachment to the fruit, we must renounce attachment to the work also. At any moment, we must be prepared to change one work, one course, or one field of action for another, or abandon all works if that is the clear command of the Master. Otherwise, we do the act not for his sake, but for our satisfaction and pleasure in the work, from the kinetic nature's need of action, or for the fulfillment of our propensities. But these are all stations and refuges of the ego. However necessary for our ordinary motion of life, they have to be abandoned in the growth of the spiritual consciousness and replaced by divine counterparts, an ananda, an impersonal and God-directed delight, will cast out or supplant the unillumined vital satisfaction and pleasure, a joyful driving of the divine energy, the kinetic need. The fulfillment of the propensities will no longer be an object or a necessity. There will be instead the fulfillment of the divine will through the natural dynamic truth in action of a free soul and a luminous nature. In the end, as the attachment to the fruit of the work and to the work itself has been excised from the heart, so also the last clinging attachment to the idea and sense of ourselves as the doer has to be relinquished. The divine Shakti must be known and felt above and within us as the true and sole worker. So, this is chapter 2, shloka 71 in the Gita. Who abandons all desires and lives and acts free from longing. Who has no I or mine, who has extinguished his individual ego in the One and lives in that unity, he attains to the great peace. This is Brahmistiddhi, the firm standing in the Brahman, O son of Pritha. Having attained thereto, one is not bewildered. Fixed in that status at his end, one can attain to extinction in the Brahman. That does not mean the disappearance of the individual. It just means that the ego is extinguished. And then in chapter 3, I think it's interesting to see these illustrations. Chapter 3, shloka 27. While the actions are being entirely done by the modes of nature, he whose self is bewildered by egoism thinks that it is his I which is doing them. And, if I may, this is in the Mother, chapter 5 again. Regarding the stages of transformation. While this transformation is being done, it is more than ever necessary to keep yourself free from all taint of the perversions of the ego. Let no demand or insistence creep in to stain the purity or the self-giving and the sacrifice. There must be no attachment to the work or the result, no laying down of conditions, no claim to possess the power that should possess you, no pride of the instrument, no vanity of arrogance. Nothing in the mind or in the vital or physical parts should be suffered to distort to its own use or seize for its own personal and separate satisfaction the greatness of the forces that are acting through you. Let your faith, your sincerity, your purity of aspiration be absolute and pervasive of all the planes and layers of the being. Then every disturbing element and distorting influence will progressively fall away from your nature. Again, the divine Shakti must be known and felt above and within us as the true and sole worker, the divine power. Now, these chapters, as you know, are broken up by these asterisks, and sometimes they're convenient, and sometimes it may seem that we have a rather short evening. This is one of those evenings when it would be rather short. We'll look in Savitri now for a passage which speaks to the annihilation of the ego. This is in Book 7, the Book of Yoga, Canto 6. Nirvana and the All-Negating Absolute. The one only real shut itself from space and stood aloof from the idea of time. Its truth escaped from shape and line and hue. All else grew unsubstantial, self-annulled. This only everlasting seemed and true. Yet nowhere dwelt. It was outside the hours. This only could justify the labor of sight, but sight could not define for it a form. This only could appease the unsatisfied ear, but hearing listened in vain for a missing sound. This answered not the sense, called not to mind. It met her as the uncaught, inaudible voice that speaks forever from the unknowable. It met her like an omnipresent point, pure of dimensions, unfixed, invisible, the single oneness of its multiplied beat, accentuating its soul eternity. It faced her as some vast naught's immensity, an endless no to all that seems to be, an endless yes to things ever unconceived, and all that is unimagined and unthought, an eternal zero or untotaled aught, a spaceless and a placeless infinite. Yet eternity and infinity seemed but words, vainly affixed by mind's incompetence to its stupendous lone reality. The world is but a spark burst from its light, all moments flashes from its timelessness, all objects glimmerings of the bodiless that disappear from mind when that is seen. It held, as if a shield before its face, a consciousness that saw without a seer, the truth where knowledge is not, nor knower, nor known, the love enamored of its own delight, in which the lover is not, nor the beloved, bringing their personal passion into the vast, the force omnipotent in quietude, the bliss that none can ever hope to taste. It cancelled the convincing cheat of self. A truth in nothingness was its mighty clue. If all existence could renounce to be, and being take refuge in non-being's arms, and non-being could strike out its ciphered round, some luster of that reality might appear. A formless liberation came on her. Once sepulchred alive in brain and flesh, she had risen up from body, mind, and life. She was no more a person in a world. She had escaped into infinity. What once had been herself had disappeared. There was no frame of things, no figure of soul. A refugee from the domain of sense, evading the necessity of thought, delivered from knowledge and from ignorance, and rescued from the true and the untrue, she shared the superconscient's high retreat beyond the self-born word, the nude idea, the first bare, solid ground of consciousness. Beings were not there. Existence had no place. There was no temptation of the joy to be. Unutterably effaced, no one and no, a vanishing vestige like a violet trace, a faint record merely of a self now past, she was a point in the unknowable. Only some last annulment now remained, annihilation's vague, indefinable step. A memory of being still was there and kept her separate from nothingness. She was in that, but still became not that. This shadow of herself, so close to naught, could be again self's point d'appui to live, return out of the inconceivable, and be what some mysterious vast might choose, even as the unknowable decreed. She might be naught, or new become the all, or if the omnipotent Nihil took a shape, emerge as someone and redeem the world. Even she might learn what the mystic cipher held. This seeming exit or closed end of all could be a blind, tenebrous passage screened from sight. Her state, the eclipsing shell of a darkened sun on its secret way to the ineffable. Even now, her splendid being might flame back out of the silence and the nullity, a gleaming portion of the all-wonderful, a power of some all-affirming absolute, a shining mirror of the eternal truth to show to the one and all its manifest face, to the souls of men their deep identity. Or she might wake into God's quietude, beyond the cosmic day and cosmic night, and rest appeased in his white eternity. But this was now unreal or remote, or covered in the mystic, fathomless blank. In infinite nothingness was the ultimate sign, or else the real was the unknowable. A lonely absolute negated all, it effaced the ignorant world from its solitude and drowned the soul in its everlasting peace. End of Canto 6. So we'll meet again on the 29th on Sunday, and bid adieu to 2019. Thanks for coming. Namaste, Jai Ma.